Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today I'm pleased to have with us Professor Amy Fox. She's a lecturer in Defense Studies in King's College, London. And today we'll be speaking about her book, Learning to Fight, Military Innovation and Change in the British Army, 1914 to 1918. Welcome, Professor Fox.
Thanks so much for having me, Charles. It's great to be here.
Professor Fox, what is the thesis of your book?
So what my book seeks to argue and to show is how a complex organization like the British Army sought to deal with the challenges of modern warfare, not just on the Western Front in the First World War, but also in its other theaters of operation. So it's really getting to the heart of how organizations try and learn, try and manage change, which of course has resonance with military organizations today.
I noticed that you work with Professor Jonathan Boff on your dissertation. How was it working with such a well-known historian in this area?
Yeah, obviously it was a great privilege. He's written widely on British and German experiences of the First World War, particularly how the German army adapts and learns. So it was a great opportunity to work with someone who's done a lot of comparative research in this area. And I think that we probably learned a lot from each other during this experience, particularly, you know, looking at things like the impact of civilian expertise on military. So it was a great experience.
Now, in the introduction to the book, you cast doubt on the so-called learning curve thesis of British military performance in the Great War. Why so?
I don't think I so much cast doubt on it. I think that it has been understood by some to be a little bit overly simplistic, that it's a case of continuous improvement, which for me suggests a kind of Whiggish interpretation of history and progress. There are many respected historians in this field, Gary Sheffield, for example, who's referred to the learning curve as a process. And really, that's where I think my work kind of takes the conversation forward, is looking at it as a process, but trying to problematize that. So not just focusing on the battlefield tactics and operations, but actually trying to understand learning in a much more holistic sense. So looking at the learning that happens between allies, for example, looking at the learning and the lessons that are taken from the civilian world and brought into the military world. So I don't so much cast doubt on the learning curve, but really trying to expand that and challenge that concept in different ways.
So in essence, making it less a reductionist conceptual framework.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, that's where my kind of networked view of learning really comes into play there. It probably wouldn't have been developed without a lot of the research and scholarship that's been written under the auspices of the learning curve. But it's just trying to bring different insights and use different methodological lenses to just expand on that concept a little bit further.
How would you characterize the pre-Great War British Army, especially as per questions of innovation and reform?
So I think the British Army pre-First World War, it suffers from, I suppose, not so much a bad reputation, but a rather sort of uneven one. So this feeling that actually it's incredibly effective at low-level adaptation because of its experiences in colonial campaigning and putting down colonial insurgencies, but that the experience of the Boer War throws up a lot of challenges that the army actually has to deal with head on. So it goes through a period of soul searching and reform. But I think to understand the British Army and its experiences before the First World War, we need to understand the nature of its officer corps, the nature of its geostrategic mission, and the challenges of actually having to try and police a global empire.
Would it be correct to say that one of your arguments in the book is that, per contra to the views of some historians, you characterize the leadership of the British Army as not being made up of, for lack of a better expression, Colonel Blimps, and that per se was not opposed to innovation and new tactical concepts?
Yeah, I think that's a fair characterization. I mean, I think that there are certainly individuals in the British Army, as there are in other militaries, even of today, in other walks of life, that are out of their depth, that have perhaps been promoted above their competence and their experience. But I think, broadly speaking, you know, these are individuals who are trying to find ways of shortening this conflict. And unfortunately, that leads to a number of failures. And I think that where particularly what I think is particularly interesting about looking at British military, senior military figures in this way, is that it forces us to reintegrate failure back into our understanding of learning and innovation. You know, innovation in itself is very much characterized by failure rather than success. But of course, when you're fighting a total war, failure is incredibly costly, not just in terms of treasure, but also in the blood that is spilt to try and bring an end to the conflict.
Overall, how would you characterize the Army's ethos on the eve of the Great War?
So I think the British Army's ethos in this period, so on the eve of the war, is one that is very much governed by flexibility. Now, that's not necessarily something we would characterize the British Army or indeed many military organizations as being. But for me, it's flexibility that's born out of necessity. As I said, you know, it's required to deploy troops around the world. They face a number of different adversaries across different terrain. So not one set of principles or tactics will suit every situation. So this is a flexibility that is deeply ingrained. And we can see that when we look at, you know, instances in written doctrine from the time, such as field service regulations, which very much captures that flexibility and how the British Army sees itself. But I think that, you know, we look at the officer corps as well as, you know, the broader geostrategic mission, to have these aspects being fixed or somehow immovable, I think sets the British Army up to fail. So it's flexible, but that is not without its challenges. It's not without its drawbacks. And I think we see some of the limitations of that flexible, more pragmatic approach, particularly in the first half of the First World War.
What is liberal learning and how does it compare to horizontal, vertical and external forms of learning?
So liberal learning, for me, it was a way of trying to capture the those kind of fleeting occurrences, you know, the conversations that happen between individuals that enable bottom-up adaptation effectively. So the conversations you might have with a colleague in our context, maybe over a coffee, those kind of instances that can't be documented, that are much more fleeting and ephemeral. And so I see that as being, you know, one of the foundations really of how the British Army learns, is that it harnesses the social element of the organization and ties that into how it approaches learning and innovation. Now, how that's different to horizontal is more, I suppose, a matter of scale. So when I think of horizontal learning, as I talk about in my book, this is about reliefs in the front line, the passing on of local knowledge between formations. And Dr. Robert Foley has written really convincingly on this about the German army in the First World War. And I think we see similar things at play in the British army. Now, what I was trying to do by trying to codify or think about learning in this kind of more networked way was to show that liberal approaches to learning can tie into horizontal approaches, and they can tie into external approaches as well. So really, it's a kind of hybrid view of learning.
Explain how connections and patronage networks worked in terms of the Army's learning capabilities.
So I think that patronage, or we might refer to them as social relations, are absolutely fundamental to how the British Army operates and also how it learns. So when we think about patronage, we generally see this as being incredibly negative. We think about patronage in quite a negative way. I think that patronage is very much the kind of the grease that enables the wheels of the organization to keep turning. And I think I would stress that the social relations that exist in the British Army, particularly in terms of appointments and promotions, that this is largely underpinned by at least perceptions of merit. So individuals are put into positions where they have proven experience or proven competence in other appointments, and are therefore put into positions where it's best felt that their skill set aligns with the requirements for that particular position. And I think because the British Army, like all organizations, is made up of individuals, that we actually really need to pay attention and foreground those social relations in how we understand organizations like the military. And it's absolutely no different in the military today. Relationships between individuals are incredibly important, whether that's circumventing unwieldy parts of the chain of command, cutting through red tape and bureaucracy. I think that we overlook the highly socialized nature of these organizations at our peril.
How did the Army's learning culture differ, if at all, from what it was in the Great War, as opposed to the Boer War?
I think that its learning culture doesn't necessarily differ. I think the scale of the task differs. And I think the element that we need to factor into all of this is twofold, really, is the fact that the British Army in the Boer War is primarily a professional force. The British Army in the First World War starts off as a professional force, drawing on reservists, but then becomes increasingly civilian in composition the closer we get to the end of the conflict. And I think that that requires the British Army as an institution, particularly its senior leadership, to think of different ways of packaging lessons and information in order to make that more accessible for civilian citizen soldiers. The second point, I think, in terms of how they differ is again, comes back to the scale, and that's the scale of information and experience. Only a fraction of the documentation, official paperwork that exists on the British Army's experience in the First World War remains and has been kept in the National Archives, and that is a considerable amount. So I think what we're dealing with here is an army that doesn't necessarily have a really formalized lessons learned process, is having to wade through considerable amounts of information and is trying to deduce lessons and best practice that it can take forward. And I think, you know, just something as simple as the advent of the typewriter actually creates a number of problems for the British Army in terms of the amount of information and knowledge that it has to work through in order to really try and codify best practice to be embodied in pamphlets and doctrine.
How exactly was inter-theater learning disseminated in the British Army, And was it as functional as other forms of learning?
So inter-theater learning is a really interesting area. It was initially what got me started on my doctoral research. Is I think that it's something that gets overlooked. I think we think about the British Army in the First World War as largely confined to the Western Front, but actually over a third of the Army's formations serve in another theater. So I think by widening our aperture and actually considering the British Army's relationship between theatres gives us a really interesting insight into how it learns and innovates as an organisation. One of the real challenges, of course, in sharing lessons and best practice between theatres is the question of relevance. You know, something that is relevant on the Western Front might not necessarily be as relevant in theatres such as Salonika, Italy or Palestine. And there's a really great example of the latest iteration of Platoon Tactics, a pamphlet that's issued in 1917, being sent out to Palestine. And the higher command there and divisional commanders looking at this and thinking that having a section of rifle grenadiers is not particularly useful when your enemy or your adversary is at greater distance. So there are attempts there to adapt and in some cases actually reject some of the, the best practice that's coming out of the Western Front in favour of more local solutions to local problems. And I think that is very much in keeping with the British Army's approach to learning culturally and historically, is that it tends to prioritise those kind of pragmatic local solutions that are based in theatre. And so you don't necessarily see as much best practice and learning coming from what are perhaps pejoratively known as the sideshow theatres, actually coming back to the Western Front in any near the scale in which Western Front lessons are going out to those theatres. But this inter-theatre learning takes place in a number of ways. You know, it's through publications, it's through conferences and training schools. But again, importantly, it's through individuals. And there is an increased number of individuals that are moving between these theatres. And so when we think about learning, it's an inherently mobile process and practice. And again, that's why looking at these individuals, their experiences and their context, what they're bringing with them, is just a really, really rich seam of evidence and research, I think.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Why, in that case, was learning from the French more productive on the individual level as opposed to the institutional level?
So I think there are a lot of different reasons for this. I think that because actually fundamentally building up relationships with individuals, building up individual trust is often the first step to being able to share that best practice. I think that institutionally, there were definitely attempts to share publications and pamphlets between the two allies. There are also inter-allied training schools, and you see this quite significantly in the Italian theatre. So there are venues and sites for that inter-allied exchange of learning to happen. But I think much of the time it's proximity in the front line that is really important, or it's, again, pre-existing relationships, particularly amongst the scientific community. Between Britain and France that really bear fruit during the First World War. So I wouldn't necessarily say that there was an institutional aversion to learning from each other, But I think that at those lower levels where you can build those personal relationships, that is absolutely fundamental, and that can escalate its way up to the institutional level. But those social relations, again, I think are incredibly important when we think about inter-allied learning.
How much, if at all, was the British Army able to learn from the French in the area of tactics as opposed to the areas of science and technology?
So that's a really interesting question. I think that tactically, the British learn a good deal from the French. And, you know, in the book, I suggest that actually British attempts to try and learn from French experience is like looking, it's for them, it's like looking into a mirror. It's holding up a mirror to their own experiences. And some British officers in particular don't quite like what they see. You know, they don't like to reflect back on the perhaps mistakes or the failures that have happened in previous operations. But there's something really interesting about the cultural predilections or the cultural differences when it comes to learning between the British and French forces. But I think actually, in many respects, certain British officers, you know, really lean in to the opportunity to go and spend time at French training schools, to spend time going around French areas of operations, because it gives them that insight to really challenge their status quo, what they take for granted. In terms of the scientific areas, you know, you certainly see, particularly where signals are concerned, for example, there is certainly attempts to learn and develop technology together, also independently. But I think in that tactical area, you almost have kind of two learning processes going on at the same time. And I think that they intersect at various points, which is really fascinating and tells us a lot, I think, about those different cultures and some of the frictions, but also some of the baggage that comes with trying to learn from an ally in major combat operations.
How do you account for the success of Australian forces on the Western Front, given their lack of trained and experienced officers?
So, yeah, that's a really interesting question. And it ties into, you know, our ideas, at least within the historical world, our perceptions of the Australian forces in particular as being really at the cutting edge of combat effectiveness. You know, I think it's interesting that when we think about the British Army, the Dominions, as they were referred to at the time, particularly the Australians and Canadians, you know, their formations are national formations, but they align in many respects doctrinally with what the British are doing. So before the First World War, Australian and Canadian formations are sent copies of the British Army's kind of capstone pamphlets and manuals. And this is really an attempt to inculcate a form of interoperability. But you also get the secondment of British officers to Duntrine, for example, to Kingston in Canada. You also get the sending over of Australian officers to attend Staff College at Camberley. So there are these kind of international links being built up across the empire effectively to try and ensure that when the next conflict comes and Britain has to call on its empire to provide forces, that there is a degree of compatibility that exists there. Now, the way that the fact that Australia has quite limited experience in terms of major conflict, you see that a number of British officers are initially put in charge of Dominion formations, and this does cause a fair amount of friction. You know, there's a feeling of wanting Australian or Canadian officers to be in charge of Canadian or Australian formations. So in the middle of a total war, you have that grappling and that need to officer these Dominion formations with Dominion officers. And so I think that's really interesting. And the British kind of step away from that role. They have staff officers that are trained British staff officers embedded in those Commonwealth or Dominion staffs. but that actually this is a transitional period. And I think it's interesting that that is occurring whilst a total war is going on as well. So I think it's there are many angles to go down or to approach this from. But that desire for interoperability in the first instance is why you have British officers commanding these formations. And as experience and expertise grows, you then get the handing over to Australian, Canadian, New Zealand officers as the war goes on.
You write in the book that the success and learning by the British Army was due to its continuity of its pre-war ethos. Given the huge expansion of the Army in the Great War, and in particularly the officer corps, how do you explain this continuity?
So I explain it in a few ways, really. Probably I'd like to focus on maybe three. The first really is that pre-war doctrine in the form of field service regulations remains in force throughout the conflict, you know, although it's supplemented with pamphlets in order to reflect the changing character of the conflict and the new tactics and techniques that are coming out of it, is that this is still the go-to doctrine. And this is pushed out to all formations and theatres of operations. And so it's very much, you know, a way of integrating newcomers into the organisation. So, for example, the Australian Imperial Force, as I mentioned, works to field service regulations, and I think that is a really important form of integration. The second is that there's continuity at the very highest levels of command in the British Army. These are largely regular professional officers who've been brought up in that tradition, and there is very much a glass ceiling for officers who are perhaps part of the territorial force or the reservists or even the volunteers. So it's those professional commanders that remain at the very top of the organization. And I would suggest that that conveys a degree of continuity as they have been inculcated and brought up in that particular pre-war culture. And then finally, and again, you know, it comes back down to this idea of socializing and socialization, is that when you have newcomers and new formations established, is that they're often appended or attached to longer serving regiments and formations. So you get that transfer of knowledge, of know-how and best practice, but you also you know, get that sense of an imbuing of that pre-war culture in these new formations. And that's used also in training schools, conferences, you know, attachment and secondment schemes. So that way of just passing that pre-existing knowledge and culture along is very much rooted in the British Army's way of doing things.
To what do you attribute the prevalence until recently of the negative views of the British Army in the Great War, that the idea that the Army was hindbound and ultra-conservative in its approaches towards learning and new tactics and new strategy?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long-standing idea, and I think that is still very much in the public mind as well. And I think we perhaps think about the British Army of the First World War in this way because, you know, one cannot ignore the scale of the casualties that occur on the Western Front, particularly in campaigns such as the Somme and Passchendaele, and this perception that the same tactics were just employed over and over again. Now, I do not seek at all in my book to whitewash or play down the tragedy of those operations. I myself have family members who were killed in the First World War. I think what I was trying to do was not to play down that angle, but was to think about this organisation in different ways and using different approaches and lenses to, you know, to really kind of interrogate what's the culture, what's the mentality behind these operations, but also what else is going on here in terms of, you know, looking outside of the organisation for expertise and knowledge and best practice. But it is an incredibly difficult idea to move past. And Professor David Reynolds, for example, has highlighted this incredibly eloquently when he talks about how, you know, the terms like the learning curve stick in people's throats in Britain, because the learning curve is greased with the blood of so many British and Empire soldiers. And I think that is something that's really, really hard to move past. But what I try to do with the book is to look at this institution as just that, as an institution that is grappling with modern day challenges, unprecedented change, and trying to understand how and why it approached the conflict and the way it approached it, really. So it's a difficult thing to argue against. And there are certainly individuals in the army, as I've mentioned, who were overpromoted, who were simply trying to, I think, learn in the way that best made sense to them, but that often had tragic consequences.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
Oh, just one. That's really hard. So probably that innovation and learning are as much about failure as they are about success. And I think that that's a particularly salutary takeaway for military organizations that are undergoing transformation programs right now. I think that there's an assumption that innovation is cheap and that it's quick. And that it doesn't take much time or resource. And my work on a historic military has shown the absolute opposite, is that innovation requires commanders in particular, but also politicians, to accept and acknowledge that there is going to be a large degree of failure and a number of dead ends before, if ever, a positive outcome is achieved. And in a day and age of austerity, of shrinking budgets, you know, that's really hard to front up to. But I would say that that is probably what I would invite readers to take away, and then they can certainly disagree with me if they choose to. But that actually, when we think about learning, you know, just thinking about it in as a messy, complex process, rather than something that is neat and simple. If people take that away from my book, then I'll be really happy.
With that observation, which I agree with, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Fox, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Coutillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Fox.
Thank you.